This podcast has been generously sponsored by Bob Karasov and Hannah Bloomfield in honor of their children and grandchildren. To learn more about sponsoring a podcast, please contact jamie@pardes.org.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit lmad.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, pardes.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. Okay, good morning, everybody. Our goal for today is to actually get into Ashkenaz, and maybe even to touch the edges of what's usually understood as the Middle Ages. But before we can do that, we need to finish up the Goenic era with just a little bit of a tale. We ended off with Rav Sadia last week, and the image I wanted you to take away from Rav Sadia's revolution in thought was that it was the elements of thought that Rav Sadia introduced into the Goenic world which really laid the foundations for the Middle Ages. Right? Rav Sadia was the one who brought, first of all, the traditions of Eretz Yisrael and Bavel together in the Gemara. He was the first really to apply the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, and the Amoraic thinking that had paralleled the Babylonian thinking, which had been known but either poorly or simply ignored by the Goenic period before him. He was also the one who brought a much broader area of literary engagement, poetry in particular, but not just poetry, polemics. Right? The earliest work we have from him, if you recall, was it a work against Anan ben David, rather, he was a big leader in the fight against charism, which is going to be quite definitive of the early Middle Ages for the Jews. He also introduced, in my eyes, perhaps most importantly, theology. Right? We spoke about Rav Sadia as a Jewish mutakalam, right? He was one of the sort of members of these interfaith debate societies whose goal was to realize truth through the path of reason. Right? He exemplifies within the Jewish tradition what becomes within, say, Scholasticism, within Catholicism, and in the Kalam, within Islam, this idea that there are two paths that lead to the same goal, reason and revelation. Right? And there was a recognition, one which I think bears some reflection in our world, there was a recognition that the path of revelation, though everyone agreed there was, like as Rav Sadia called it, immediate knowledge, most people just don't have what it takes, present company excluded, of course, to reason their ways to the truth. Right? There are a lot of stumbling blocks along the way, and it takes a lot of work, an intensive lifetime of effort. So revelation is essentially a gift from God. Hence, right? It's, I mean, here you go. I'll just give you the truth instead of having to work for it. The problem, it's the subtext, in my eyes, of what the Kalam says. The problem is that revelation lends itself to conflict. Right? Why? Because, as I said, in these debate societies, they were not allowed to resort to scripture or revealed truth. Because if I'm debating and we were resorting to revealed truths from our separate religions, it will come down to my God is bigger than your God pretty quickly, and then whoever has more power in the political sphere will quash the other person, and we know how that goes. It doesn't end well for the Jews, generally speaking. You know, even today it doesn't end well with the Jews. So therefore, within the Kalam, the emphasis was on reason. Interestingly enough, as we pointed out, the Arabic world's attachment to Greek philosophy had, so to speak, sanitized it for the Jews, right? When Greek philosophy was at its height, we were in conflict with the Greek culture. So therefore, eventually the rabbis, who originally were quite enamored of Greek philosophy, when they saw the cultural package that it came with, you know, there was a histagut, there was a sort of a drawing back, even one could say a revulsion, you know, and the whole Hanukkah story and the struggle with the Greco-Roman Empire, we're not going to go through it again. But when Greek philosophy and modes of thought reemerge in the hands of Arabic thinkers, detached from Greco-Roman culture, embedded within a culture which is much more sympathetic to the Jewish way of life, the Arabic culture, right? Therefore, they felt perfectly free to readopt these modes of thought because they are very powerful modes of thinking. If you believe that reason is a path to truth, you cannot do without an in-depth understanding, even if in the end you reject the philosophical principles, you can't do without an in-depth understanding of Aristotle and Plato. You just can't do it. It's like philosophy, even if philosophy has moved well beyond that, you don't learn to think without at least going through that phase. So At least not in the Western canon. Sorry, it'd be so culturally relative. So we will actually probably not speak about Averroes because we're not going to speak about Spain. There's this gap in between. But just to answer your question quite briefly, he was a Muslim jurist in the Iberian Peninsula, in Islamic Spain, who was responsible for translating much of Aristotle's work into Arabic and had a tremendous impact on the Middle Ages. His name became synonymous with heresy within Christian medieval Europe. So we may speak about him another time, but for now, Averroes, there are a number of ways. I mean, obviously, his name was in Arabic. I have it in my notes what exactly. If you really want to know, you can send me an email. What? It could be Ibn Rushd, yeah. He's not the only one, but yes, the Rambam encountered Greek philosophy, Aristotelian in particular, which was so important to him, through the Arab thinkers, yes. But we're not going to talk about Spain. So I can't do that, because keep it in mind, even though I'll slip into it a little bit inevitably today. So Rav Saadia, what I want you to appreciate is he created these sort of intellectual framework for the Middle Ages. And we have a tendency to think of the Middle Ages as kind of like backwards and sort of like primitive, etc. But particularly, as maybe we'll speak about a little bit later, there were waves of renaissance, of intellectual ferment and sort of social reconstruction that happened in the 9th, in the 11th, in the 12th centuries. It's not just that, so what's known as the classic Italian Renaissance, which comes much later, say the 14th, 15th century. But there were waves of early Renaissance that led to the High Middle Ages, which were, for the culture of the time, a very rich and diverse intellectual environment. And for the Jews, the seeds for this were laid by Rav Saadia. But, of course, he is over in Bavel. And just a couple of more Gaonim, just to wrap up the picture of what's happening there, and then really the bulk of today I want to spend in Central Europe, or Central Western Europe, depends on how you define it. Okay, so the two more personalities that you need to know in order to understand how the Gaonic period plays itself out. One is Rav Shrera Gaon. Rav Shrera, if you recall, Rav Saadia Gaon was Gaon in Sura until, I believe, 942, I think is the year that his Gaonate ended. Rav Shrera was a later contemporary. I mean, that he wasn't Gaon for 100 years. That's how long he lived. We don't know exactly the dates, or I don't know exactly the dates. I'm sure if I looked hard enough, we could find it, when he was Gaon. But that's not critical. What's critical is that Rav Shrera and Rav Hai, who was his son, really represent the sort of sunset of the Gaonic period. They're tremendously powerful in their ability to wield religious authority, tremendously impactful in the tshuvot, in the responsa that they wrote. And yet we'll see by the time Rav Hai Gaon dies in 1038, what we think of the sort of the era of the Rishonim, of the early medieval authorities, has already begun in both Spain and in Europe. This is a question, and Spain, Europe, and North Africa, frankly. It's a question that we might have to ask, that we'll consider as we go along. But just a couple of things about their contributions. Rav Shura's greatest contribution that we have today is what's known as the Igeret of Rav Shura Gaon. An Igeret is a letter. It was a question which was sent to Rav Shura from Rav Nissim of Kerwan. Kerwan was a major Jewish center in North Africa. I think it's in present-day Tunis, but I'm not 100% about that. North Africa was a very important Jewish center even in the time of the Roman Empire, remembering that the coastal fringe of North Africa is a very rich area for both trade and in places agriculture. So the Jews, as Josephus tells us, before the Roman Empire even destroyed the temple, were already well dispersed. And if you, those of you who recall our story of the three Roman Jewish wars, the Kitos War, the middle one, war number two, right? A lot of it took place in the Jewish communities of North Africa. Those communities have re-emerged. We'll speak a little bit about that story as we get into our transition. They've re-emerged, and so Rav Nissim Karwan sends a message, a question, a series of questions, Rav Shrera, which says, we want to understand the order of formation of the Mishnah. We want to understand why Rabbi Yehuda Nasi left out the Tosefta, which is a parallel structure to the Mishnah, as we spoke about, right? Even though it has a similar structure, it lacks seemingly the authority, because the Mishnah is considered to be the prime text, and Tosefta, as the name indicates, is the additional. We want to understand what are all these braitot, all these Tanaitic statements, which are preserved nowhere else but in the Gemara. Where do they come from? Why didn't Rabbi Yehuda Anasi make those organized? And tell us about how you get from the Mishnah through the Gemara. And we want to know, once from the end of the Gemara, like, how do we get to you in the generations? Now remember, this isn't just historical curiosity. Since the assertion that there is such a thing as the traditions of the fathers, this roots of the Oral Torah, it is bound up with an integrity of a chain of tradition. Do not lose sight of that. So therefore, when Rav Nissim writes and asks, we want to know about how the Mishnah came forth and like, how do we understand the generations of the academies and the Gemara, part of what he's asking is this the real thing? Can we now, when I receive this Gemara, because of course they didn't have it, they had the Mishnah, and they were slowly getting the Gemara as the Gaonim were spreading it. I mean, it could be that, you know, there was someone who showed up one day with a copy, but the Gaonim sent out, as we'll speak about, shluchim, messengers, who would go out to raise money for the academies, also to assert their authority, and also they would send out people who had the Gemara memorized, who would then find a copyist who could put it into print, well, not print, into writing. There was a question I saw out of the corner of my eye. Yeah, Jeff?
Some of the writers are in the Tosefta, is that correct?
Well, I mean, properly speaking, a Braita is nowhere else but in the Gemara. The Gemara will cite the Tosefta as a non-Mishnaic Tanaitic source. So yes and no, meaning the Tosefta is cited by the Gemara as standalone statements. But now that we have recompiled the Tosefta, we consider there to be the Mishnah, the body of the Tosefta, which is of a slightly higher grade than many Braitot, which are simply floating statements in the Gemara that have no other sort of structure of integrity. So the question goes to Rav Shrera. He understands full well that what's at hand here is not a technical issue, but an issue of authority. And so he writes what amounts to the first modern, in quotes, work of Jewish historiography. He explains exactly how you get from the process of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi until me, Rav Shrera Gaon of Pampadita, at the turn of the 11th century. And in doing so, sets another foundation for the Middle Ages. Because he, in the minds of his correspondents, dismisses, I mean, obviously there's a lot of polemic against the Karaites in this, remember, because the Karaites are arguing that this is an illegitimate endeavor, and one of the ways you'll always do that is by arguing you've lost track of your tradition anyway, right? It's also an argument against the sages of Eretz Yisrael in some subtle ways, because we spoke about that whole polemic between Babylon and Eretz Yisrael and how the fight was over integrity of tradition, right? Furthermore, he marshals, and by the way, it's not such a long letter. It's not easy to read, but it is worthwhile. It has been translated for people who are interested in such a document. Very rich. It's one of the places where we encounter the questions of what's the nature of machloket. Because, of course, if you argue an integrity of tradition, you're going to have to answer the question of, well, okay, then how come we can't agree on anything, right? Is that a lechatchila or a bidyeved? Is it an accident of history? Or was it part of the original intention? You know, Shura has his own opinions, as we've spoken about. It's also somewhere else that we encounter the question, did Rebbe actually write the Mishnah down? Or was it orally composed? Did he inherit a text? Some structure, as it seems to be implied by the Gemara and a few Midrashic statements, that there was a, so what we would call a proto-Mishnah, the Rabbi Akiva, the Mishnah of Rabbi Akiva, as it's often called, right? So there are many, many important statements. A lot of them belong to our discussion of the Mishnah, as we've spoken about before. People want sources because they want to pursue that. You can always send me an email. But for our purposes, what I want you to know is he gives us the last piece, right? Which is a grounding in a, I don't want to call it a historical reality, we call it a historiographic reality. You know what the difference is? History is, in theory, an objective reality. Historiography is how you tell the truth. No, sorry, how you tell the story. Whoops. That was a Freudian slip, huh? It's how you tell the story of history. And so self-consciously, you will always be forced into some sort of meta frame. You understand what I'm saying? Right? Just always remember, crossing the Rubicon. Right? This is my example. What does it mean to cross the Rubicon? Right, it's the point of no return. And why do we use it as such? It's the story of Julius Caesar. When he enters Rome, there was a rule. The Senate had passed a law that any general who has absolute dictatorial power over his legions in the field, who crosses the Rubicon still at the head of his troops, they're all liable to death for rebellion against the Senate, which means either you're going to be the new ruler or you all die. Hence, it's the point of no return. But as I've pointed out many times, how many people have crossed the Rubicon? I mean, there's a bridge over it. They cross it all. There are probably thousands of people on cars right now crossing the Rubicon. Nobody cares. Because the reason that it mattered that Caesar crossed the Rubicon, the fact that it became an expression, even though I admit it's a dead expression in the modern English language, sadly, but is because it's part of a larger narrative of Western society. Caesar crossing the Rubicon mattered. Right? And so in the same, that's historiography. It's like you're gonna take the, it is a fact that he crossed the Rubicon, but it's also a fact that you know, if I ever go visit Rome, I will too. I don't know. But it's not one that's necessarily of historical importance. So Roschreira, in giving a solid narrative of how we get from the sort of Ur text, the primary text of oral law, to his day, answers Rav Nissim Kerwan saying, basically, between the lines, what he's telling him, and now you can trust me to move on from here. Because this is what's going to happen. Rav Shreira dies, as we all do. Rav Hai Gaon inherits his position, which was not an uncommon phenomenon. The Gaonet was not a hereditary position, but it's always been, by the way, even amongst the kings of Israel, that if the son is male makomo, right, if a son is appropriate in wisdom and authority to fill the place of the father, so then that's always the best pick. But vice versa, the converse is true as well, that the idea of a hereditary kingship even was not a given. Even within the house of David, true, we want to stay within the house of David, but we're not going to necessarily take his firstborn son just because he happened to come out first. We want to know, is he going to be the appropriate king? If you read the stories of David's household, that's one of the elements that's going on there. There are others. Right? It's not easy to have children. So we're going to mark the end of the Gaonic period, and obviously there's much more we could speak about, but I'm interested in the Middle Ages. We're going to mark the end of the Gaonic period really with Rav Hai Gaon. But don't be deceived. The Gaonim and even the Exilarch exist for another couple hundred years, even in Eretz Yisrael. There's a certain point where the Gaonit will move into Egypt in its residence. I mean, the history of the Middle East as a whole here is a swirling history. If you really want to say, like, when does it all disappear, likely we would say the year 1258. Why? I didn't write up there. Because that's when the Mongols sack Baghdad. And, you know, and the Mongols, of course, are the blender of you know, sort of Central Asian history. And it's like once they come through, they leave a lot in their wake, but it will never look the same. Right? So. But for our purposes, the Gaonic period, by which I mean the last living central authority, even though we've seen they're contested and they're carrots and they're Israel and people are far away and not everybody listens, but they are the last claim to centralized living authority that Am Yisrael has seen to this very day. That's 1,000 years, and it needs to be appreciated, the astounding success of maintaining any sense of national integrity after having lost a living authority for 1,000 years. You know, the Protestant Reformation was only 500 years ago, right? And if you look, there are Christians of every flavor, right? Now, we have a lot of Jews of every flavor out there as well, but it's been 1,000 years. And if you're concerned, as I am, about the sort of, I don't know if you guys saw that article in the New York Times about American Jewry and Israeli Jewry, what's his name, Weissman, whatever, he's a writer, I don't even know what his background is. And at the end of it, he says, the great schism is at hand. You guys know what the great schism was? Yes, I think it was 1057, something like that, somewhere like that. Good, very good. Meaning...
So he's predicting
the schism. It hasn't happened. Frankly, I'm very concerned about the situation between American Jewry and Israeli Jewry, but I'm not that concerned. We've had these problems before, you know, and these splits and the coming back together and this group fades and that group grows and, you know, like, it needs to be treated, but I don't think panic is called for.
You say 1,000 years, where you started from? I mean, I would have thought the heavens had better leave earlier.
No, I'm saying it's been 1,000 years since we've had living authority, central living authority.
Not from then to
Yeah, it's approximately 1,000 years. Before you know it, it's going to be 2038. And at this point, I look back and like, when did it stop being the 80s? It's going to matter for us, and in particular, Rav Shrera's efforts to set Am Yisrael on the foundation of what? On the foundation of the Gemara. I use living central authority. And that is exactly my point. There are many authorities, but why is it then that they don't completely diverge from each other? Because we know this splitter instinct amongst Jews is extreme. And we've spoken about this fact that there's a very fine line between you don't do it like I do and you're not a Jew. We've seen this already with the Karaites, right? And we've seen it back in the end of the Second Temple period, where it led to actual destruction, right? And you're absolutely correct. What maintains, what unites the, let's throw out some names, the Rif, the Rosh, the Rashba, the Rambam, the Ranban, all these incredible authorities, what unites them? There's only one thing really that unites them. One simple thing, as many things, but one simple foundational thing. What?
The Talmud?
Yes. They're all working within the Gemara. And that's what I meant when I said that Rav Shrera gives us the last element, meaning Rav Saadia gave us an intellectual context and a cultural matrix, and the Gaonim in general finish the work of the Talmud so that, as I pointed out to you, it becomes a cultural matrix. You just put it down, add water, and poof, you've got the Jews. We spoke about the calendar. We spoke about the Sidur. The last thing we have is a story that can give us the authority. And never forget, by the way, you tell the story, you run the show. Everything else is commentary. If I can establish a narrative within which you live, then you may move left, right, center, up, down, but you will always be within the story that I tell, which is why you want to be very careful buying into other people's language. A student asked me the other day, you know, is where you live a commentary on the legality of the occupation? I happen to live in Maale Adumim, which is over the Green Line. So I said back to them, well, I'm not going to allow you to define my existence with your language. You hear the question. The question is a whole narrative. There's a whole narrative. And I'm like, your political opinions are your own. You can accept that narrative, you can disagree. I do both. My point is that you hear the power in the question. That's what I mean. But when Rav Shrera answers Rav Nissim Mikerwan's question by establishing the authority of the Gaonim on the basis of the continuity of tradition, what he does is he allows them to hand off the Gemara, which is the source that the Gaonim all point to. Even though they're a living authority, they're all pointing to the Gemara as their source of authority, so that when the Gaonic period fades, we'll say, instead of ends, they're all left holding the Gemara. And then the Gemara becomes the central authority of Am Yisrael, which is why, during the age of the Rishonim, we'll see, what's everybody involved in? The Gemara. Yeah, either commentary or eventually legal codes, and then eventually what we call Torah Lishma, like the learning of the Gemara for its own sake. We'll talk about the Tosfos when we get there and the sort of rebirth of the dialectic. So the whole fascinating world that will all take place for the next 800 years or so within the Gemara. And that will certainly define the Middle Ages. So, in many ways, that brings to an end the story of the Gaonim, although I want to tell one story in order to really seal it off. Before I tell the story to end, questions or comments? It's not like we can't go back to the Gaonic period, but we're done.
So Rav Shrera writes
this Igeret, this letter, which is a tshuva.
It's a tshuva history.
Yeah.
So the question is, since he didn't go to the Gaonim and having this information, he's still a person.
Excellent question. I mean, not only is he a person, but he also does not adhere to what eventually becomes the Western standard of history, which is objectivity. Meaning, even there is no such thing as, well, that's not, I shouldn't say that. There is a notion from antiquity that history, when told, should be representative of the actual events. At the same time, there is a sense which is inherited from antiquity, which we would do well in our day to think about, that history is never neutral. So therefore, if you're going to tell a story, you also want to make sure you get people to where you want them to arrive. And so therefore, beyond human fallibility, there's also an agenda. There is almost no parallel sourcing, in particular for the lists of names. Now, there's a lot of academic debate. There are bits and pieces, and there's work that's done. There are critical editions of Rav Shrera's Igeret, but it's more along the line of internal narrative than objective history. At the same time, it is, in for many cases, the only documentation we have for the chain of attribution within the sort of late Amoraic period. And there are other people, by the way, this becomes a phenomenon in the age of the Rishonim, writing books of what are called Dorot HaRishonim, if people have heard it, right? Or the Sefer Kabbalah, right? These attempts to establish history as lineage, intellectual genealogy as opposed to... I don't know if you call it an alternative, but it is absolutely a reality. In general, and this is a gross oversimplification, but in general, the reason that the Gaonim didn't look to the Rishalmi is because they felt it was unfinished. It had never really received the level of intensive study that the later Amoraic period gave to the Bavli. That being said, like I pointed out to you, once Rav Saadia reintegrated the two traditions, they understood it to be quite important. Yes. I can't go back there. If you're interested, I either recommend you listen to the class on the Mishnah, or you can send me an email and I'll send you some material. But yes, Rav Saadia has a particular perspective on how it began, which is an important question for the world in which we live today, because is our goal consensus, in which case machloket is at best a sort of ad hoc situation and at worst disastrous, or is our goal something else, in which case machloket might actually be an a priori. Other questions or comments before we wrap up the Gaonic period with one of my favorite stories? So the story is from Sefer Kabbalah, which I mentioned is written by Rav Avraham Ibn Daud in the 12th century, 1160. He was in the Iberian Peninsula, good Jewish family. So the book was written by and large, it's also one of these sort of historiographic intellectual genealogies. That's why it's called Sefer Kabbalah. Don't mistake the word Kabbalah, which today means Jewish mysticism in most people's minds, doesn't receive that meaning until the 13th century, at best. Right? Before that, it means one of two things. It means, what does the Gemara mean when it talks about Divrei Kabbalah? Well, but it usually means Nevi'im and Ketuvim. So specifically speaking about not the five books of Moses within the Tanakh, usually that's what it's referring to. Or, as you said, in its simple sense, it's just inherited tradition. Just whatever, we're not going to go back to the Kabbalah discussion. If we get to Spain, we'll speak about the origins of the word, but the Sefer Kabbalah is using it in a historical sense. So he tells the following story. He says, around 960 of the Common Era in the Christian dates, right, that the academies of Bavel sent out four leading scholars with their families on, you know, we would call a fundraising mission, right? They were going first to Bari, Italy. Right? Italy was a very important Jewish center of the time. Had one of the oldest Jewish communities outside of the land of Israel. There was a community established in Italy even well before the destruction of the Second Temple. So they were sent there first. I guess that's where the rich Jews were. It was Rav Shmaria, Rav Hushiel, Rabbeinu Moshe ben Enoch, and the fourth apparently is not known. He couldn't have made it up. I don't know. You're going to teach them about how to tell a story. So in those days, remember that the whole Mediterranean was split by the battle between Islam and Christianity, right? And the control of the seas in particular was very important, and they were infested with either pirates or privateers. You guys know what a privateer is? It's a freelance navy. It's a freelance navy, right? Meaning if you have a navy, that means you have a government that actually equips ships and hires, you know, trains, naval, et cetera, and then you have to, like, maintain them and pay them a salary, et cetera. Another thing you can do is hire a pirate who already has a ship and a crew, and you just give them a flag. Because remember, under maritime law, right, maritime law, states can make war on each other, and that's a state of war, and you deal with that as you have. Or if you're at peace, there are either explicit or implicit laws of the sea of how you deal with each other. And what's a pirate? Pirate is a maritime anarchist. They Right. Well, but they're worse than criminals. They're maritime anarchists. They hold by no law whatsoever, which is why the punishment for a pirate internationally, I don't know if it's still applied today, is instant death. You know, that everyone, the pirate is the victim of everyone. His hand is against all, and all of his hands are against him. But if you take a pirate and you hang, I don't know, a British flag on his you know, mast, suddenly he's legal, and he's still doing the exact same thing, only to a very particular subset of your enemies. So the Christians and the Muslims were waging this sort of privateer's war on the Mediterranean. A lot of that, of course, the business end of it was slavery. Right. Remember that slavery, even today, unfortunately, is alive and well, but certainly in the 10th century, was really thriving. So the story goes that there was a sea captain named Ibn Muhammad who captured the ship with these four great sages upon it, and he took them all as prisoners, and now he knew that these were Jews, and they weren't just Jews. He could tell that they were important Jews. And so rather than just simply sell them into slavery for the value of their labor, he went for ransom. And he took them to the large Jewish communities of Egypt, Tunisia, Spain, and Italy. Starts out in Alexandria, where he offers up Rav Shmaryahu for sale, and the Jews of Alexandria pay in full, right? So he goes on to live in Old Fostat, which is Old Cairo. And when the Jews learned that he was famous Rav Shmaryahu, they asked him to become their chief rabbi. Boom, now you have one Gaon, or one student of the Gaonim, in Cairo. Ibn Muhammad continues along the coast. He reaches the great port of Kairouan. Oh, I have it written down in Tunisia. Great, I was right. Right, he brought out his second captive, Rabbi Hushiel, and they, of course, ransom him there. Now, you should understand that Rabbeinu Hushiel becomes the teacher of the Rabbeinu Hananel and Rabbeinu Nissim. Rabbeinu Hananel, which we're not going to do right now in North Africa, I'm just going to give you, you'll see why I'm telling you this story in a moment, right? The Rabbeinu Hananel writes the first systematic commentary on the Gemara. Now, why does that matter? Aside from the fact that that's cool and probably fairly difficult. You know what writing commentary on the Gemara does? It detaches it from the Gaonim. Why? Because now if I want to know what the Gemara means, I've got this helpful column right next to the text that tells me. This is part of what we call the democratization of knowledge. Because the either conscious or unconscious result of a centralized living authority is if you want to know what the Gemara means, you just ask me. Suddenly, the students of the Gaonim here through our story at the agency of a pirate are being spread across North Africa, in Cairo, in Kairouan, and we're bringing with them this Gaonic knowledge and planting the seeds for a culture of learning which can exist separate from the Gaonic center. So Rabbeinu Hananel, who, by the way, is always your best friend on the page, if you're ever learning Gemara, just remember that. If he's there, he'll always help you out, even more than Rashi, by the way. Anyway, that's just a helpful tip for me in your learning. So the Rabbeinu Hananel and ultimately Rabbeinu Nissim, who really become the real bridge to the area of the Rishon of the early medieval authorities. So on goes our pirate to Spain. By the way, apparently unloads the fourth guy in some unknown destination, but because it says it's the last of his four great captives, Rav Moshe and his wife and son. So the story is that he casts anchor at Cordoba. Now, what's happening in Spain at the time, just to give you a little context, that around 910 and 942, the remnants of the Umayyad Empire, the Umayyad Caliphate, which was the third of the caliphate, they had ruled the Muslim world. They'd been overthrown in around 752, I think, is the Abbasid revolution. The Abbasids moved their capital to Baghdad, which, as we spoke about, ultimately is where the Jews all congregated in Baghdad as well, which is why when Baghdad falls, it's kind of the end of that period. But the Umayyads were down but not out, and the remnants of their household took refuge in the Iberian Peninsula, which is the furthest flung element of the Muslim Empire, except for maybe the Indus Valley. It depends on how you look at far flung, at least to the west. So, and there, eventually, they created their own caliphate. Remember, they were emirs. They were sort of subject kings for a couple hundred years, 150 years, and then eventually they went sort of, what's the word? They went independent, right? And Abd al-Rahman III declared himself caliph, and it matters for our story now, we're not going to go into it, because the Jews are deeply bound up with his caliphate. He was a great lover of knowledge. His physician was Chasdai ibn Shaprut, whose name is famous in Jewish history. He is the archetype of the Jewish doctor, you know, made good, who becomes the unofficial advisor and he really sort of almost the vizier to the king. He's a diplomat. He connects Muslim Spain to very important forces within Christian Europe, right? Like I said, we can't go there, but I want you to understand that Chasdai ibn Shaprut is the one who's there in this newly formed caliphate when the pirate shows up with Rav Moshe and his son and wife. He then ransoms Rabbeinu Moshe, and the story is that they didn't know who he was, and he was very humble, so he took a job as the shamash, like taking care of the shul and sweeping, and one day the local rabbi was giving a class while he's cleaning up in the back, and the rabbi says something, and the shamash says, "No, you're wrong." And the rabbi changes what he said, and he says, "No, you're still wrong." At a certain point, like, the argument breaks out between the shamash and the rabbi, and everyone was like, "Well, I think you guys need to trade jobs." And they realized that this was one of the great students of the Gaonim, and the story, you know, he lived happily ever. It's the intellectual Cinderella story, right? But why does it matter for us? Because what's the unites all these elements of what's admittedly a fun story by Ibn Daud? What unites them all? They all came from the Gaonim. They all end up in what become three of the major centers of Jewish life and learning. Right? Which means that what you're witnessing here is the story of how the Gaonic period actually came to an end. Right? Because the Gaonim, as the last central living authority, right, everything was supposed to be directed toward them. The money, the questions, etc. What happened here is now their students, however you want to understand the narrative, their students went out, established their own academies of learning, and in particular, Chasdai ibn Shaprut and Rabbeinu Moshe established in Spain what becomes a thriving Jewish culture, which we call the Rishonim. And these are the people who become Shmuel HaNagid and the great poets Dunash, the author of the first Jewish dictionary, so Hebrew dictionary, so to speak, the Machberet, and his name is Ibn Chasdai. That's wrong. No, Chasdai ibn Shaprut. Ibn Saruk, Menachem Ibn Saruk. Again, we're not going to talk about Spain, so you don't have to memorize. There'll be no quiz later. But the point I want to get across is that this is happening while Rav Shrera is still alive and teaching, and Rav Chaya hasn't even come around yet. And we already are seeing that there's a transition. Just remember that this idea of periodization, of breaking up history into these nice, neat chunks, is a myth. And it's helpful for general discourse, but it's also a dangerous one because it can confuse you into thinking, you know, that history has clean breaks. And why does it make a difference if we're in the Gaonic period or the period of the Rishonim? What difference could that possibly make aside from an academic one? And therefore what? It's a descent in authority. The major difference will be whatever these students of the Gaonim taught in Spain, as shot in the Gemara, oh, this is what the Gemara is asking us as a legal discourse, they do not presume to apply to the people who live in North Africa, to the people who live in Babel. As opposed to the Gaonim, who when they said, this is what the Gemara is asking, they said, this applies to everyone, and ipso facto, if it doesn't apply to you, you're not a Jew. Right? This is one of the major characteristics of the shift in the age of the Rishonim. Local, many authorities, but they are local. Right? And because of that, they will, on one hand, wield much more authority, because if you have a local authority, he actually knows what you need, he understands your culture, he can answer your questions, say, li'inyan, right? As opposed to somebody who's over there in Bavel, doesn't understand your social context, may not even really know what you're asking. But that's on one side. On the other side, however, what you're getting is divergent stories. And now when you add to that the fact that the Jews of Spain, the Jews of North Africa, the Jews of Egypt, the Jews of Babel, eventually, as we're going to speak about today, the Jews of Europe, are going to have very different sort of national historical arcs, just different experience through time, right? Different cultural contexts, because the non-Jews of the Rhineland don't look anything like the non-Jews of the Iberian Peninsula. So the cultural context, when you add those, what you get is divergent communities, right? Go back to my daughter's story, Dvar Torah, about oil and water not mixing. Right? What you're seeing now in the age of the Rishonim is the pace of the fork is picking up. And every blow to that oil, which will not mix with the water, nevertheless gives you these ever smaller clumps of oil, which cling to each other, cling to themselves, but they won't stick to each other. So that the Jews of Spain will become the Jews of Spain, and the Jews of North Africa will become the Jews of North Africa. I'm not saying never the two shall meet, but they'll have an increasingly divergent experience.
But in one sense, by losing, they win because their views get spread all over the world.
I don't understand what saying.
The Gaonim, the views of the Gaonim, as it were, yes, it's split apart. But on the other hand, that is the source of a good deal of.
It sure depends on what their goal was. And like, listen. For much the same, the Jews are, in our era at least, are, let's just say, somewhat skeptical of centralized authority. Most Jews outside of the Kurdish world, and even there, even though nominally the Kurdish world claims to be very enamored of centralized authority, if you look at the fragmented nature of Kurdish society, really is that they want absolute authority, not centralized. Right? In the Haredi world, which claimed, was the Haredi, sorry. You heard my yeshivish Ashkenazi accent there. So meaning there's a claim for a desire there, but the sociological reality doesn't really reflect it. But like, you know what the major benefit of centralized authority is? Just imagine we were all standing on a football field right now. All of Am Yisrael. It's a large football field, or small people, right? And I get to be the centralized authority. I'm standing at the front with a megaphone. I say, everyone take 2 steps to the left. Have we moved? It's an important question. No, but you understand my point is that if everybody moves, so on one level, we haven't moved at all. And so therefore, that link between law and identity that I pointed out to you guys is the central pillar of the rabbinic project can be maintained even in the face of the most radical changes. Because, okay, now everyone take 2 steps back, right? Like, do whatever we need to do. The problem is now I want you to picture, same football field, but we're going to put a guy with a megaphone on every 10-yard line who's only speaking to the people here, but of course everyone else can hear them. So 1, 2, 3, let's all give instructions. Go to the left, right, go to the left. And first of all, you have cacophony because you can hear lots of them. And that will be, by the way, the age of the Achronim when we get there. Like, you can really hear lots of them. Once the printing press comes online and I could actually have a stack of books about what people think all these authorities who I'm nominally bound to, but who actually can't be reconciled. That's one thing. The other thing is I'm going to take a left and I'm going to step on your foot because you were going right. And then I'm going to start saying, you're not on the right. Or, who's in charge here? You hear it? I mean, go out in the streets. Right? Am Yisrael, God bless them. I didn't hear what you said. So we spoke a little bit about that power with the Gaonim a week or two ago, I don't remember. It's one of the ways that people will reconcile the fact that the way we do it here isn't like the Jews do it over there, but we're all still Jews. At the same time, as I pointed out, you walk around Jerusalem. What's the Minhag HaMakom of Jerusalem? Depends on who you ask, right? Rav Avadya Alav HaShalom, it was insistent that everyone here should basically convert, so to speak, to being Sfaradi. Why? Because the Beit Yosef, the Rav Yosef Karo, was the last central authority of the land of Israel. Therefore, we should all be doing it. He actually had a Beit Din where you could do annulment of your vows as an Ashkenazi and join the team, which in his mind was the proper team, right? And the Hasidim weren't doing that. Neither were the Ashkenazi. Well, like I said, what does it mean to say that I'm an Ashkenazi Jew? I daven Nusach Ashkenazi, go to an Ashkenazi shul. I've never been to the Rhineland. None of my ancestors were in the Rhineland, not at least since the, let's say, 15th century. Like, what does it mean that the Poles were Ashkenazi Jews? That's not Minhag HaMakom, because they carried their custom with them. That's a modern concept of identity. It's related to Minhag HaMakom, but the Gemara in the fourth parak of Pesachim, when it speaks about Minhag HaMakom, is talking about physical place. Okay. Yeah. We're going to get to that right here. Because polygamy doesn't end for the non-Ashkenazi world until their encounter with the laws of the state of Israel. Not in any formal sense. I mean, some places sociologically it faded out. Okay. So, fun story. we've got a lot of framework built. Now we're going to go back in time because we got to tell the story of Ashkenaz. First of all, where does the name come from? It's an interesting notion. Like, you know, you ask people, are you Ashkenazi or Sephardi? They just will answer you one way or the other, or they'll deconstruct the question or whatever. But nobody says, what on earth is this Ashkenaz you're talking about? Where's the name from? Are you making fun of me?
No, it wasn't you.
Oh.
Somebody was going to Germany.
Oh, okay. I was like...
No.
Yes.
I really listened to Paul, and they were talking about the origin of...
So it's a biblical name. It's a biblical name.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. And I have the pasuk here, if you're curious. It shows up in Bereishit. It shows up in Divrei Yamim. It shows up in Jeremiah. The early reference in Bereishit is, these are the generations of the sons of Noah. Shem, Ham, and Yafet. And they had sons born after the flood, the sons of Yefet, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Yavan, Tuval, Meshech, Tiras, the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphat, Vitogarma. So Ashkenaz is one of the sons of Gomer, who is a son of Yefet, who was a son of Noah. What does that have to do with the Rhineland? First answer is nothing. Right? I mean, they, from a geographic standpoint, it is an absurdity. There are people who do attempt to sort of like make these possible connections through this tribe in Turkey and or the Black Sea region. And I think the answer is quite simple. What you're hearing here is mythic topography. Remember, these are Jews who are living within a very solid story. Now, where their local story starts, we're going to unfold. But I want you to understand, the name Ashkenaz is critical. Because just imagine, you've been telling a story your whole life, and you heard the story from your parents who told it to heard from their parents about, we were slaves in Egypt. And then we went out and we got the Torah at Sinai. And then Eretz Yisrael and the conquest, and then the destruction of the first temple, and we came back in the second temple, and then all that stuff makes sense. And then when I say, there's no black forest in the Bible, and who's ever heard of the Visigoths? And things get confusing very quickly, and you get the sense that you're off the map. Maybe the story has somehow fallen apart. And don't forget, by the way, this is not neutral, because there's another team of people out there who used to be Jews who are telling you, yes, the story is over. You are off the map. Right? Who are those people? The Christians. Right? And so it becomes incredibly important culturally to stay in the story. So suddenly, when I look out the window, no glass panes, likely, there in the Rhineland, I don't see Germany, which, of course, the name doesn't exist yet, but I don't see, the kingdom of the Franks, right, and the Gothic people. I see Ashkenaz, and I see the children of Esav, right? And suddenly, I know exactly where I am. I'm still in the story. Right, the name Ashkenaz grounds me, as does the characterization of Christianity as the children of Esav, as will, by the way, the characterization of the children of Islam as Yishmael. And by the way, just to make it complete, where are the Jews of Spain right now? They're not in Spain. They're not in the Iberian Peninsula. Where are they? In Sfarad, which is also a biblical reference from the Sefer Avadja. It goes, we won't go now, but it goes to the heart of the fact that the Sfaradim see themselves as the nobility of Am Yisrael, because it says in Sefer Ovadia that they were the exiles from Jerusalem who were in Sfarad, right? So we see in both cases that there's a tremendous need for a mythic topography, right? Because then I can go anywhere and I can be inside the story. This is a very important sort of instinct. I don't think, by the way, that this was a conscious decision. Like the rabbis got together and were like, well, this isn't going to work if we're in Italy right now. It's got to be, you know. And that's not my point. My point is that as you've heard from me 100 times, and I'll say it 100 times more, the story is the most powerful tool for survival and for growth and for change and for stability. I mean, it is the most powerful tool. And so, therefore, the need for a mythic topography to locate ourselves in Ashkenaz is really what's embedded in the term. Neither here nor there, and we're going to talk about them. A little bit, we'll talk about them. So, and by the way, we see already in terms of like where does the term actually show up? Rashi, as we'll speak about if not today, then next week, Rashi, who becomes this sort of great shaper of classic Ashkenazic culture, right? He will say that in Lashon Ashkenaz, right? He gives it in the language of Ashkenaz. And it was clear when he says it that his readers understood what he was speaking about, which means that already by, you know, the, say, 11th century, there was already a sense of this is where we are. And I just want to be clear, why do I think that's so? Because they could have very easily called where they were whatever the local people called it. Right? But this is not what was needed. Right? There were no history books. They didn't have maps on the wall in the classroom, the globe that they were looking at, and so where's Ashkenaz? I can't find it. Right? They're living within their own internal narrative, and the need for grounding that attached them straight back to the book of Genesis is, in my eyes, the primary need. Okay, so that's the a word about the name. By the way, where is classic Ashkenaz, just so we can get it straight? The Rhineland is that border area. I'm not going to talk about whether it's France or Germany. World wars have been fought over that. But it's, the Rhine River runs through the heart of. That's classic Ashkenaz. And as we go forward over the next, you know, few months in the second semester, we'll speak about why most Ashkenazi Jews think of, are actually like of Polish and Eastern European ancestry. How did that come about? That's a long, slow process. But for now, we're talking about classic Ashkenaz. There is a tradition, internal Ashkenazi tradition, that says that actually there were Jewish communities of what would become the Rhineland as far back as the time of Ezra, that they were refugees from the destruction of the first temple. And this you find, like I said, you find this amongst Ashkenaz, you find it amongst Sfaradim. Why? Because again, you want to attach yourselves all of it. By the way, there's also a subtext, at least it's actually explicit in amongst the Sfaradim. I suspect it's true here as well, which is that, see if you can figure it out, if you're living in a Christian culture, why would it be important to claim that you are descendants of a Jewish community that was exiled at the destruction of the first temple?
Before Jesus.
Yeah. If not just you came before, say it louder. You didn't kill Jesus. No, it's very important. It's explicit in the Sephardi sources, and I suspect that it is what's being taught in the Ashkenazi, except in the Ashkenazi, we have to do it in a sort of self-flagellating way, because their tradition is that it was their refusal to heed Ezra's call to return that ultimately brought on their destruction 1,500 years later in the Crusades. So it is related to the killing Jesus thing, but it's in a uniquely Ashkenazi, like we're punishing ourselves for it. I suppose the Sephardim would be like, no, like, I didn't do it. Like, listen, if I've been around, who knows, right? But either way, identifying a root in their culture which predates the whole Second Temple period is not neutral. But that's the internal sort of Ashkenazi narrative, as we call it. It's clear from the archaeology and the historical records as far back as Josephus that there were Jewish merchants and suppliers that accompanied the Roman legions wherever they went. Right? This is the area that Rome called Gaul. Right? That when they crossed the Alps and started to head a little bit west, it was sort of all Gaul. Right, and we're going to speak about how it fell in a brief sense soon. And so the communities that they built were left there when the legions dissolved. Right, Rome falls, the legions dissolve, what were known as the limes, the sort of military boundary that Rome set where the legions were encamped on its boundaries, collapses, and the Jews are left like sort of flotsam and jetsam at high tide. It's like, hey, where did the Romans go? Like, hi, we don't speak your language. But we're very good at trade, right? It's a huge question amongst archaeologists and historians about did those communities dissolve in the early Middle Ages when Rome collapsed and then everything was built anew? And if they dissolve, what does that mean? Did they all just die? Did they convert Christianity? Did they pack up and go somewhere else? It's highly unclear. Or did they have some sort of continuity? For our purposes, it's not going to be critical. Now, just to give a little bit of context to what's happening in Europe before we actually get to the fully internal Jewish narrative. Classically, we say that Rome falls in 476. I say classically because Rome gets sacked a number of times before that and even afterwards, too. The Lombards come along and, like, 476 is the last Western Roman emperor. The Goths. I think it was the Visigoths at that time, although it could have been the Ostrogoths. Don't quote me on that. We can just call them the Goths, and I can be safe. Right? Germanic tribes. Right? Germanic tribes. Remember that already around about the beginning of the 4th century, Northern Europe, meaning like Scandinavia, Northern Europe, begins to boil over with humanity. Just literally, just spills over. And what become known as the German tribes begin to just migrate southwards, conquering, taking the land. Rome's first encounter with them is a rather difficult one. Eventually, what happens within the Romans is that they start out as being enemies. There are gradually, Rome cedes a certain amount of territory to them, and they become sort of treaty allies. And ultimately, Rome co-opts many of these tribes into the legions because they've got a lot of more vim and vigor, right? But since the legions play a critical role in Roman society, they end up basically co-opting the Roman Empire. That's a very grossly simplified picture of what just happened. But for our purposes, it is a critical piece because the encounter of Roman sort of republican culture, remember, Rome is not a democracy, but it is a republic. And one of the big differences is that, you know, one of the reasons Rome was so unstable is that every legionnaire could dream of being emperor. And many of them, in fact, succeeded. Right? And it was one of the reasons that Rome was so unstable. At the same time, it's something that tends to appeal to the Western consciousness. It's like, well, there's no intrinsic difference between the emperor and the legionnaire, except for the circumstances of life. But if a legionnaire plays his cards right, you could be president someday too, right? You ever heard that phrase, right? That's a Roman concept, the Roman Republican concept. The German culture is a tribal culture who believes that their ruling families descend from the gods. It's the exact opposite, you know? Meaning, I don't care how good a warrior you are on the field. I am, I don't know, Hedwig the Great, right? My ancestors descended from heaven. I'm king here. Now, you know, granted, those things are probably somewhat flexible because if you lop off my head and claim to be, you know, the Kingslayer, then maybe you were descended from the gods too. But by and large, those are two very different cultures. And when they mix on a political scale, the Republican and the sort of tribal semi-divine will produce the feudal culture. Feudalism. Will produce the feudalism, right? And in particular, one of the hallmarks eventually of late feudal culture is going to be divine right monarchy. Now notice how that's how Christianity adapts to the German conception of divinity within the human being. You understand? Christianity did just fine in the Republican culture of Rome, because who is the supreme power in Rome? Well, the emperor, but the pope. And in the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, the emperor is the supreme head of the Catholic Church, Orthodox Church, sorry. I mean, the ideal is that the political ruler be both the political head and the ecclesiastical head. That is actually true in the Western Roman Empire as well. It's just that once the emperor disappears, and there are some sort of German aspirants to that throne who claim that status here and there periodically, but we'll see a rise of the papacy as an independent, and the Pope of Rome begins as the Bishop of Rome. He's just another bishop. Granted, he has a certain status because of the whole Peter Association and the rock in the church, et cetera. I don't want to necessarily go into the history of Catholicism, but he doesn't necessarily have more status than the Bishop of Antioch, or one of the oldest seats of Christianity, or Jerusalem for that matter, a very important place, right? But what happens is because Rome was the political authority of the Western Empire, and the original conception of Christianity united that political and the ecclesiastic authority, so the Pope will gain increasing status as a religious leader, but not necessarily as political. Because who has the real might behind them? The German tribes. Right? Like I said, ultimately this is going to become what we know as divine right monarchy, which is that I'm not a god, but God gave me the right to rule this land. Right? And so it's not the republican notion of Rome, although the nobility will persist. And I'll sketch out the picture of feudalism for a second. I just want you to understand where these things come from. So it's the encounter of those two, plus two other very important elements. One is known as latifundia, which is the concentration of land, ever larger amounts of land, into ever smaller numbers of hands. Yeah. This is a phenomenon that just occurs world over. It's a fairly well-recognized economic phenomenon, that wealth breeds wealth. And in the pre-industrial world, wealth equaled land. So therefore, it's much easier when you're wealthy to accumulate land than it is when you're poor to hold on to it. Right?
That's what you're
That's what Yosef did in Egypt, precisely. Yeah, no, economic crisis is a good example. Economic crisis caused latifundi, because the poor were marginal landholders, had to sell their land for survival, and the wealthy, who weren't faced with a survival issue when the value of land plummeted, were able to concentrate. It's a very good example of what was happening in Rome at this point. Right? Last piece to understand the feudal world. So now would you picture what were happening? We're getting this increasing power of individuals who aren't constrained by a republican system. You're getting the growth of, and when I say latifundi, I'm not talking about like 10 acres estates here. We're talking about the size of modern European countries being held by individuals.
They came with slaves.
Oh, well, they came with serfs. which is the next piece. Right? That Rome made a distinction originally between the free man and the slave. Right? And there are all kinds of legal consequences of what status you have. We see it also in Jewish law, right? Legal consequences of ability to enter into contracts, including marriage, the ownership of property, all kinds of consequences. Toward the sort of late antiquity, as the financial situation in Rome was going under, you know, the basic presentation of what happened in Rome is that there was an ever smaller amount of wealth being shared with an ever more narrow layer of society. This may sound familiar. And in order, now the Roman Empire did not function in the way of a modern sort of liberal nation state, by which I mean they didn't collect taxes in order to distribute services. Right? That they collected tribute and gave services as an act of nobility. Right? It was an assumed obligation of certain positions to invest in infrastructure, to pay certain sort of public functionaries, etc. Which meant that holding high office was potentially a very expensive obligation. The theory was, but you could always take more than you had to give, and there was a culture of noble, so that's how you showed yourself to be wealthy and powerful. You built roads and fountains and bathhouses. You know, you equipped legions. You did what you needed to do. Well, what happens when the wealth starts to dry up? Once the expanding sort of market of Roman conquest reaches its limitations, and yet you have an increasing demand for consumption and a shrinking pool of resource, like I said, it might sound vaguely familiar, right? So you know what the Romans started to do? Well, suddenly it becomes a liability rather than a great honor to become the legate of this or that. So they start to chain everybody to their post. Right? Toward the end of the Western Roman Empire, and certainly going into after its fall, a caste system develops in Rome, where positions of importance become hereditary, and you are obliged to fill them. And if you flee your post, we will bring you back. So in the wealthy world, it meant that people went into tremendous debt. Amongst the poor, what happened is the coloni emerge. Right? People who are not slaves, but they're bound by law to their land. So that if I purchase, as one of these wealthy Romans who is concentrating land, if I purchase a large tract of land, I get with it the people that are actually working the land. Are they my slaves? No, they're not my property. They can enter into contracts freely. They can conduct marriage freely. But if they leave their land, I can bring them back in chains. Well, they're called coloni originally, but we know them in the feudal world as serfs. Right? And the boundary between serfdom and slavery is very thin, but legally significant. Practically, sociologically, how significant was it? I don't want to go into that right now. They're not your property, and they can enter into free contracts. Instead of they're limited, you may own some of their labor, because usually if you're working land, you have collective responsibilities, say for harvest or improvements. I may own a number of days of your labor every year, but you're still technically free, except for the fact that if you leave, I'll bring you back in chains. You're serfs of the land, and that becomes the foundational social element of what we know as the feudal world. Right? So now we have all the pieces. Let's just say them again, you guys can ask questions, and we'll talk about why do the Jews, where do the Jews fit in this. Right? We have this ever-increasing concentration into what began as private estates to become countries. Right? We have the I didn't mention it, but the return to natural economy. I mean, the assumption is that these places produce everything that they need. The monetary economy in what's known as the early Middle Ages, or the so-called Dark Ages, more or less dissipates. Like, coinage just disappears. Because remember, coinage is what allows for me to get from you what I need that I don't produce, or for me to sell to you the excess of what I do well in order, you know, but that depends upon a certain system of trust and relationship. And what happens is that in this process, that what emerges or reemerges, or returns, is what's known as the natural economy, which is that I produce everything I need. And therefore, I don't need you as my neighbor. And you know what else I don't need? Money. Except if I want to do one thing. You know what I need money for? War. We'll talk about that in a second. There was a question over there. So, yeah. The serfs are chained to the land. So the owner owns the land. The serf has certain rights of working the land and feeding their family, and they have certain obligations to the owner, either a percentage of the crop or a number of days of year of labor, say in harvest, all the serfs have to come together and work for the Lord, right? Or both. And you can imagine, by the way, is the serfs got deep in one bad year. And what happens is the Lord, like in the Joseph story, gets a larger and larger percentage of the crop. And then there is a line between serfdom and slavery, which is very gray. Although, you know what the benefit to the Lord is between a serf and a slave? You don't let your slaves starve. But the serfs, I'm not responsible for them.
But it's also another class, which are sort of tenant farmers, and they classic feudal.
Peasant. Yeah, but that's a later development. That's the true feudal era. Right, so the peasant farmers are a strength, and they'll bring about what we call the High Middle Ages, because they're freemen who either are tenant farmers who own more rights on land, or they're actually small freeholders. But that, again, I don't want to get too much into the architecture of the feudal era. There are a couple more pieces I do need to add, though. You always listen. The barter and coinage doesn't disappear entirely. My point is that the monetary economy that had flourished under the Roman Empire begins to fade. Yes, we're going to get to that. But I want you to picture the context within which European Jewry emerges. That's my goal here, right? So within this is one last critical piece, which is, what is the sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? The conceptual framework of feudalism. I like to call feudalism, by the way, the agricultural military complex, right? That on a simple level, right, if I am in the great lord, and I own all this land, right? And for some reason, you as a noble, you come to me. You know what you do? We make a contractual relationship. You swear fealty, right? And I give you a fiefdom. That's the relationship. You swear fealty, I give you a fiefdom. A fiefdom is usually some portion of land, but it doesn't have to be. It could be tax rights on a well-traveled road. It can be fishing rights on a big lake. It could be almost anything. But the key is that we're bound by an oath of fealty, right? You're bound to me, and I'm bound to you. Now, the original conception of feudalism is that these are not hereditary. That I'm, as a lord, yeah, I got all the power here. You swear to me, and when you die, it reverts back to me. What will happen, and this is a lot of the history of European political development that I want to go into now, is what happens at a certain point that slides into my son will go and renew his oath of fealty, right? And, you know, I'll either give it to you or not. It becomes pro forma, where now my son shows up and you've got to renew. And at a certain point, my son doesn't show up anymore because this is my fiefdom. Now, why does that happen? Because, like I said, the military-agricultural complex. What's the basic idea? If I'm the lord of land, I've got enemies, right? Of course, everybody who puts up a flag gets enemies overnight, right? And if I want to fight, I can do two things. I could maintain a large standing army, which does not exist in Europe until a much later period. Why? It's extremely expensive, both in direct costs and in indirect costs, because I'm taking my primary labor force. Remember, all my wealth is bound up in land. I'm taking my primary labor force off the production line, so to speak, and I'm going to feed them? Like, forget it. It's like a double loss, passive and active. So rather than do that, I'll give you a fiefdom, and in return, you'll say, when I blow the horn, you're going to show up with 50 pre-armed, which is an expensive process, guys on horseback. And then we'll all go out, I'll summon all my counts, I am the king, because I'm all my counts and dukes and whatever I call them, right? And you will come running, and that's why it's a military agricultural complex, because the more land I get, the more fiefdoms I can grant, the more fiefdoms I can grant, the more military might I can muster, the more military might I can muster, the more land I can seize from my neighbors. You see the process, right? And so this is a very powerful process, but there's one very important element that you can't get around, and this is where the Jew comes in. Liquidity. Yeah, you at a certain point, you've got to equip these people. You've got to bring armor and horses and arrows and swords, and you will have to feed them while they're in the field, which necessitates some degree of cash. But you, as your feudal lordship, are bound up in pigs, lumber, and wheat, which are not so liquid. So you know what you can do? You can mortgage it. And who are you going to mortgage it to? Who is the liquid element of the feudal empire? The Jews. Now, not the only ones. And we'll speak about the fact that it is a very important myth of Christian history that the Jews were the only money lenders in Europe. They were, in fact, were not even the most numerous. But the Jews hold a very important place within feudal society, which is why I took all the time to describe this. Because you have lords, you have fiefdoms, people who have sworn fealty to the lords. You have the serfs who are bound to land. You will have eventually the emergence of the true peasant. And by the way, if you know European history, freedom is noblemen plus peasants, right? If the nobleman can speak to the peasant's interests, then he can break the hold of the lord. And like in the emergence of what are known as the townships in Europe is a lot of the history of the emergence of European conceptions of freedom. That's not part of our discussion. But where does the Jew fit? The Jew can't own land for most of European history. Spain is an exception, by the way. Most European history, due to the laws, the outgrowths of the Justinian Code and the Visigothic Codes and just the general conception of the role of the Jews don't own land, right? The Jews certainly aren't lords. And there's a problem with the Jews swearing fealty. I don't know if you know, but the Jews are not to be trusted. They don't believe in our God. Because you know, we see, if you look in the Gemara and Nedarim, the Mishnah, you know, and Shvuot, like, what's an oath? You swear an oath. What, unfortunately today, it's kind of a joke, but what is an oath in the human understanding? It's beyond a promise. It's a binding contract witnessed by God. So it's more than a promise, because a promise is between you and I. It is a binding contract witnessed by God, and in the medieval mind, if you break it, you're going to hell. Like, you know, the civil and ecclesiastic authorities in this world get you, but that's nothing to compared to be, you know, I don't know, boiling in human excrement in the seventh level of Dante's Inferno. I don't know, right? You know, so that's a very powerful, and by the way, even though I'm mocking a little bit, you see the Gemara Nedarim and the whole Jewish conception of oaths is the exact same thing. Different God, same picture, right? The person's word is binding, both because it should be, just on a sort of moral plane, also on a sociological plane. Just imagine if people actually meant everything they said, how different the world would be. And there's a theological, so to speak, frame for it, which is if I don't get you in this world, they'll get you in the next. And that, to us, I don't care how religious you are, to 99.9% of the people living in the world we live in, that's an interesting idea, but it doesn't grab you by the kishkis and keep you up at night. You understand? I broke my oath. I can't live. That's not the world we live in anymore. But it was the Middle Ages. That's what I'm saying. We ascribed perhaps to the theology. And we may even be willing to say that I believe that is so, but viscerally, if I put my hand on a Bible and swear something, I'm not sweating bullets, which is why you see in Jewish law the phenomenon of, oh, I'll pay instead of swear. Like, no, all the time you see it's like, I'd rather pay a debt that I don't owe than have to take an oath. Like, it's a very serious thing in Jewish tradition to take an oath because we use the name of God, right? So Christian tradition has the same conception, and it is at the heart of the feudal culture. When you swear fealty, that's a binding contract before God. The problem is the Jews are not to be trusted to swear before God. So therefore, they don't really fit the feudal system in that sense. There is something, what's called the Mora Judaica, one of the great histories of institutionalized anti-Semitism in European history. It's the Mora Judaica. There are always a series of oaths that the Jews were meant to take. Now, I'm not talking about feudalism, just talking in court, if two people are contesting, you know, because like, even today, at least in American courts, I don't think we do it in Israeli courts, and today in America, before you give testimony, you put your hand on the Bible and you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but truth, so help me God, right? So where do you think that comes from? Now it's like a pro forma act, but it has its roots in European culture. But the Jew wasn't going to put his hand on the Christian Bible and swear. He himself wouldn't do it, and the Christians weren't going to let him. So they came up with this formula called the Mora Judaicum, which could range everything from, you know, swearing on the Jewish Bible to making him stand on a pig skin wrapped in a hair shirt, right? Swearing that all the curses that the Hebrew Bible can imagine from Datan to Aviram and Sodom and Gomorrah and everything else you can imagine should come down on my head if I, you know, don't, you know, sort of keep faith with my word. Right? The descriptions of what was done in medieval Europe are, well, they're downright medieval. Like it's really quite dramatic. So the Mora Judaicum is a recognition of a problem of how the Jew doesn't really fit the conceptual framework of feudalism. But he does fit in one very good place, is that the Jew becomes the serf of the king. Right? He's not a slave. He's a serf, which means he's the king's indirect property. Which on one hand is good news for the Jews. Yeah, because it's just like if the king saw a bunch of noblemen out beating his horses, the king would say, hey, get your hands off my property. What are you doing, you jerk? Those are my horses. So in the same way, if the king sees the noblemen abusing the Jews, in theory, he'll do the same thing. He'll protect them.
Why would you say indirect? Weren't they just the property?
Because they're not slaves. They're not slaves. They can enter into contracts. This is makes a very big difference. In fact, it's the king's advantage. You know why? I'll tell you what the real kunz is, because these kings, they were smart, right? The Jew goes to a nobleman who wants to go to war. Just to give you an example of how this all works. So the nobleman has, I don't know, 100 acres of walnut forest. Valuable, but not so liquid. So the Jew says, I'll mortgage that to you at, I don't know, 11% and this much and so on. All. I mean, here's the cash. So the nobleman goes away, fails in his venture, comes back and says to the Jew, listen, I don't have the money. Jew says, great, that land is mine. Except you know what? Oh, Jew can't own land. So you know who it goes to? The king. It's a very convenient way that the kings will be able to concentrate wealth and power into their hands. Which is why the Jews will play an ever-increasing role in the concentration of absolute power in European history. Which is why it is a hallmark of European history, and perhaps some would say to this very day, I mean, there aren't so many Jews left in Europe, but America counts, of the relationship between Jews and absolute power. The Jews will always, in European history, favor absolute power. It's a multipolar world which is most dangerous to them. Where do the Jews get the money to cough out? Where all those Jews get that money from? So there's another part of this story, which is that just imagine when Rome falls and nobody knows how to get anywhere anymore. There are no maps. I mean, there are maps, but they're extremely rare. Most of them, of course, on the edge say what? Thar be dragons, right? Meaning, it's all well and good that you have a map of your locale, but you get to the ocean, no compasses, right? Like, where do we go from here? I don't know. You're going to get in a boat and sail off into the blue and hope you get to some faraway place where they have those spices that people are willing to pay so much money for? I don't think so. But there was a group of merchants who are known as the Radonites. Right? Very murky in the historical record, although it's very clear that they existed, usually sort of placed between about 500 and 1,000. Why do they place it there? Because the fall of Rome, and 1,000, by the way, is the rise of the Italian city-states. When in the Crusades and where this economic structure shifted, but the Jews will dominate this phenomenon. They're the ones who will preserve the trade routes that were established under the Roman Empire in a time where people no longer know where to go. They're literate. They are multilingual. They have family in Baghdad. I just want you to picture that I'm in Cordoba. Pepper in Cordoba is a very valuable item, right? I get a bag of pepper, I can get a sack of gold. Now, if that means I have one bag of pepper, I sell it, I got a sack of gold. What do I do now? Buy more pepper. Except you know what happens? So I throw that gold in the back of my donkey, go riding off toward, I know how to get to Baghdad. I go riding off toward Baghdad. You know what happens as soon as I get out of the city limits? Yeah, the first non-Jew who sees the Jew with the donkey and the gold, it's a quick trip to Baghdad, right? So that doesn't work. So you know what else the Jews have? Letters of credit. Because I don't just know where to go to get to Baghdad. I have a cousin, Shmuel, in Baghdad. And my cousin Shmuel, he trusts me. We grew up together, or we didn't grow up together. We've written letters, etc. So I'll give you a letter to my cousin Shmuel. You give me 1,000 gold coins. I'll give you a letter to my cousin Shmuel. It says, give the bearer of this letter 1,000 gold coins. So you walk out of Cordoba with that donkey. The non-Jews stop you, and they're like, what is this piece of paper? It's worthless to us. I can't even read it. You know, even if it was in the language that I spoke, I couldn't read it. It's not even the language I speak. But when I show up, you show up in Baghdad, you go to Shmuel, he says, so how's David? He's like, sure, no problem. I'll give you the money. You're able to meet the spice merchants. You know, you make the deal. You end up back in Cordoba. I sell them off. I give you, I'm not interested, no interest, but you were a business partner in this. And that's what the Heter Iskav, people are familiar with it. You know, it becomes a very important part of Jewish history, right? I'm not giving you interest, but I'll give you a cut of the profits because you took risk, right? And suddenly, business is booming. And so one of the ways that the Jews maintain liquidity is because they are both the large-scale, these Radnites, the international merchants, and they maintain the Roman trade route that connected East and West up until more or less the Crusades. Usually the year 1000 is what's said because that's when the Italian city-states begin to emerge as real traders, and then the Crusades open up that route for Europe. One second. And the other piece is that the Jews will maintain crafts and small-scale commercial life, right? And so, therefore, even, a lot of the sort of modern sociological research is the image that we have of Jewish moneylenders is Isaac of York. You guys read Ivanhoe? If you haven't read Ivanhoe, you need to read Ivanhoe, right? So Isaac of York is the wealthy Jew who's, got the finest horses and the cloths and the jewel. Okay, those guys existed, but the vast majority of Jewish moneylenders were where the peasant comes to you with his hoe and says, I need to pay my tax to the Lord, right? Can you give me, 2 copper coins? I'll get it back to you in a month. And you keep the hoe and you give him the coins. I mean, there was a lot of that very small scale trade as well. It's a trope of European culture. Rebecca, you're speaking about in Ivanhoe. You just wanted to mention her, or what? Just to get her out there. Yeah. Well, by the way, the trope of the beautiful Jewess is a very important trope in European culture. I have all kinds of suspicions about why that would have been, but it is its own story. If you haven't read Ivanhoe, gotta read it. In fact, maybe I'll read it again sometime soon. That's a good book. You wanted to say something?
It's the same point.
Right, and the vast majority are impoverished. And I would like to point out again, like I said, is that numerically there are far more Christian moneylenders than Jewish. Just perforce, by nature of things, there were way more Christians than Jews. Church forbid it. Church forbid the Christians did it anyway. We all know how religion works. But the Jews play an important role because, I'll say it now, even though it really applies to Spain better. The Jewish relationship to absolute power is very simple. Jews are loyal, diligent servants who are easily discarded, right? And so they're perfect servants for absolute power. Discarded, right? They have no power base of their own. If the Lord such and such becomes my minister of finance, I can't just kick him out. You know why? Because Lord such and such has holdings. He might have fealty servants of his own. He's got a power base. Whereas the Jew, tomorrow, I kick him out and start telling everyone he's the one that was, sucking the blood of the good Christians of my town. Everyone says, yeah, the Jew. Nobody cares.
And all your debts are now.
Right. Diligent, loyal, easily discarded. Right. And so, therefore, on one hand, there will be an ever greater relationship between Jews and absolute power. On the other hand, it rarely ends well. Right. That's not an exaggeration of European history. So we've got more or less the pieces of the feudal culture in place. So just a couple other elements here, and we got only a few minutes left anyway, so we'll probably end with Charlemagne. So like I said, in terms of the internal sort of Christian narrative of Europe, the papacy becomes its independent power gradually. It's usually Gregory, it's called Gregory the Great, was pope in around 590. It's usually seen as the turning point of the papacy. Very interesting historical character. He was the first of the popes who came out of a monastic background, and shifted a lot of the Christian understanding of European Christian understanding. This was the Eastern understanding. He spent time in the court in Byzantium, so he had a very interesting intellectual background. But bottom line, Gregory is the one who was responsible for converting the British Isles to Catholicism, and through that had a huge influence on finally converting the German tribes to Catholicism. Remember, the German tribes were already Christian, almost universally. Of course, there's plenty of places where that fight took a long time, but many of them were Arian Christians, who were seen as heretics. How that happens is a story beyond us, but it's a fascinating quirk of history that it was Arian priests who first converted the major German tribes, which led to Christianity, as opposed to it uniting Europe in the early period. It actually led to greater divides. If you remember the Nicene Council and Constantine putting the power of the emperor behind a unified Christian creed, that failed in Europe for the first few hundred years. But Gregory is really this sort of turning point where you can generally say, if we're going to create a Christian Europe, a Catholic Europe, mind you, right? Gregory would be the beginning of that process, and the Battle of Tours really is its consolidation. What's the Battle of Tours? Battle of Tours in around 732 is the Muslims, you recall, right? We were talking about them quite intensively for a while, cross the Straits of Gibraltar in the year 711, work their way through the Iberian Peninsula very quickly, and they're threatening to cross the Pyrenees and take what is today known as France. They're stopped at the city of Tours by Charles Martel, right? Charles the Hammer. Martel means hammer. Who will then retroactively be characterized as the defender of Christianity against Islam, right? And again, at the time, it was a battle, invading armies. You know, who knows how many pagans were in everybody's camp? Hard to know. But Charles Martel becomes, in European consciousness, the defender of Christian civilization against Islam. And so therefore, if you're going to speak about Christian Europe, it really begins, at least retroactively, to come into being here. He creates what's known as the Carolingian. Well, actually, his son, Pepin the Short. You got to laugh. Today, could you imagine? No. No, you wouldn't call him that, right? But apparently his father was Charles the Hammer. He got Pepin the Short. Better than Pepin the Fat, who comes later. The bald, yeah, exactly. It's like, really, you're the king. You couldn't get them to call you something else? Anyway, he founds what's known as the Carolingian dynasty in 751. And it's actually under Pepin, Charles's inheritor, he comes close to reuniting Western Europe under one rule. Right? Yeah. It apparently is under Pepin that Jewish communities begin to reappear slowly within the Rhineland once again, right? And then his son Charles, in 768, will take the throne of this Carolingian Empire. Charles, of course, is better known as Charlemagne, right? And just to end off our story in the last 2 minutes here, just because I'm forming the context for Christian Europe as opposed to just feudal Europe, and then we fit the Jew into the feudal structure. We're going to have to fit the Jew into the Christian structure. That'll begin next week. Charlemagne, what happens in a very brief sense is that in the year 797, the Eastern Roman Empire, was Constantine VI at this point, was removed from the throne by his mother, Irene, declares herself empress. But, you know, as I pointed out to you, the church regards the Roman emperor as the head of Christendom. And therefore, in their eyes, has to be a man. So Pope Leo III needed a new candidate. He's here in Rome, still recognized the Byzantine emperor as the Roman Empire, because he's still got a real empire. And so he looks around Leo, right? And Charlemagne had done a good service to the church by defending the peninsula of Italy from what was known as the Lombard invasion. Doesn't really matter, right? And so on Christmas Day of the year 800, Leo III crowns Charlemagne emperor and brings back the title in the West for the first time in over three centuries, creating the Holy Roman Empire, which will exist until the 19th century in various forms, right? Napoleon basically breaks his back. It still has a remnant even after Napoleon, but he basically dismantles it. What? Well, eventually of the German nation, but this is the Carolingian Empire. This is pre-Germany. And by the way, Charlemagne was more French than Germany. So it's an edgy question there, but we won't go into it right now. But what's key to us is that we have a rebirth of a unified political entity within Europe, but who put the crown on his head? The Pope. And now you understand why we have Christian Europe as opposed to just feudal Europe or Roman Europe. And we'll speak next week about what that means for the Jews.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.